This is a recording of Alina Preston on January 16th, 1978.
No.
And you're going to put on that, too.
Excuse me, where was I? Now we are back in the sewer, right? Okay. While in the sewer, we were always exposed to danger, of course, all kinds of danger. I did talk before about the flooding, right? And how once we really thought we were going to make it, we were lifting up the children, and then the water began to subside. We had another fire, I said before about the fire, burning my handkerchief. We had once a really bad fire. When I was in London, I met Mundick. He reminded me how the fire was so bad that his eyebrows and eyelashes were burnt and his hair was singed. What happened, there was an explosion of the Primus, and we really thought that that was the end of it. They grabbed the blanket with which Babcia was covered and tried to smother the fire. They dug up some from underground, from the ground, some dirt and so forth. Anyway, somehow they managed to help that. The worst, of course, was the fear of being uncovered. And one time we were sitting there, and we heard a noise that sounded like our sewer workers coming, and it was coming closer and closer, but it somehow didn't sound like the same rhythm or the same splash of the water as it did of our sewer workers. When they came closer, we didn't see the turning of the flashlight, and then we realized that we were uncovered, we were holding our breath. And as we were sitting silently, after a while, the noise subsided, the people turned back. When our sewer workers came back the next day, they told us what was happening. They said it was the first snow had fallen on the ground. At that time, we kept moving, incidentally. We moved several times. That time, we were not far from the Bernardine Church under a park. And apparently above us, the snow melted in the shape of an L, which was the shape of our pipe. And the Germans became suspicious. They sent down some people to check what was happening. They thought maybe some Russian prisoners of war were there or whatever. So they sent down some sewer workers, and the sewer workers came down and didn't see a thing, and they came back and reported. So when our sewer workers were at the sewer works at the time, at the office, they explained it to them that no, there's no reason to worry, there are no Jews, the Jews were drowned or poisoned long ago, but it's possible, they said, that this is the heat from the nearby monasteries of the church and the steam from their kitchens, connected with the catacombs or whatever, that maybe that's it. Then one time, time was passing, of course it was already months, it was already a year, and we had heard of the Germans retreating and the Russian army coming closer. And then one day we heard knocking and something like digging or drilling above us. We became very concerned, we were very worried, and our sewer workers came running in, not at their regular time, and said we better do something about it. Oh yes, about the, they said the steam was coming out through the manhole. I don't know why, we didn't know why that day was worse than any other time. But the little bit of fresh air that we were getting was through the closest manhole. But through that very same closest manhole was coming out the steam from our cooking. So the steam was coming out, and again the Germans became suspicious why there was steam. So our sewer workers told them that the steam was coming up from because it's warm inside, but it's cold up there above. But they came down to us and they said we must plug up that manhole. So they took whatever they could find. They brought some rags, and as she reminded me, we had a huge. It's sort of like a banyak, it's called in Polish. It's like a, what would you call it? Oh, I can't think of the word right now. And that helped to plug up that manhole too. At any rate, they came down and they moved us quickly into another pipe. This was one of the many times that we moved. Another thing that we couldn't unpuzzle, there were things that the Germans couldn't unpuzzle, but there was a thing that we could not unpuzzle, and that was a certain strange noise that was going zzzz, and then another one zzzz, and we would sit there underneath in the sewer wondering, what can that be? Well, finally, one day, we asked our sewer, well, that was still early, but that was specifically under that, when we were in the park, and the sewer workers came down and they told us that those were the children on roller skates going back and forth, and not to worry about that. One time, and this I remember distinctly, I mean, this was a horrible thing. One time we woke up choking. It was impossible to breathe, and we were choking in our throat. And we could smell gasoline. And we were breathing in that gasoline. It was absolutely terrible. And we figured it had to be a few things. Either that some gasoline truck spilled, or somebody spilled gasoline into the sewers, or there was an explosion up there. We couldn't pinpoint what it was. Whatever it was, it lasted, I would say, for about 2 days and was very, very hard, very difficult. That was another memorable thing. The Russians were coming closer. Oh, yes, and I started to say before we heard drilling and knocking and hammering above us. And our sewer workers came down and they told us what was happening. The Germans began building shelters. That was, of course, marvelous news for us, but it was also dangerous. So there we have to move again. And each time we moved, that really meant uprooting ourselves. And it also meant for the men to find, for those who went for water, and some of us women, to get acquainted with the new routes for the water. And speaking of water, each time one went for water, it was taking a big risk, a big chance, because, as I said before, we didn't know when it was cloudy, when it was raining above. And it happened that they would go for water, and if they were caught in the pipe, then they were just pulled away, as happened with Kuba, I told you that he didn't return. Unless, if you were caught in the pipe, and if you could make it to a spot under a manhole and stand up and hold on there until the storm subsided, then you were safe. We lost in this fashion also some people. How did we, they were building the shelters, the Germans were building the shelters, but our sewer workers came on time. And instead of moving us this time, I think it was, they told the Germans to stop building there. They said it's too dangerous because there are water pipes and gas pipes in this particular spot, and they recommended that they better do it over there. So the Germans stopped and they did it over there. Well, it was by now 11 months, 12 months, a year, 13 months, and the Russians are already closer. Our sewer workers come down and tell us, and we start talking about liberation and when liberation will come. Of course, we were worried about it, not only that the Germans themselves are going to go down look for shelter, but the bombs, you know, one didn't feel like dying now from a bomb. But still, these were happy signs that redemption was close. And we talked about what we'll do when we come out. We did, throughout our stay in the sewer, first of all, we thought we were the only Jews that would survive. We were sure that we were the only ones in the sewers and possibly the only people who would survive. And we thought that if Hollywood, there was no television yet at the time, but just to spend the time pleasantly and you know, to dream and lift up our spirits, especially Jakob, he was ignorant, he was illiterate, as I said, the little hunchback, but a brilliant man. He had known every single movie and actor. Apparently this was his only diversion in his native town. And he was a very religious man, a very intelligent man, and he would. He had a whole plot of the movie that the Hollywood people are going to produce after we are liberated. That when Hollywood's going to find out, they're going to come to Lvov, and we are going to bring them down into the sewer, all of us, and show them where we were, and they're going to film all of that. Also, Mundek was very, very bright, also a big city man, and they would discuss all kinds of things. I remember Jakob compared himself often, I think, to Toulouse-Lautrec. You remember, Lautrec was also a hunchback. And I think he dreamed that maybe someday he will achieve what he could not achieve in pre-war. At times, he was thinking of still going to school, you know, and so forth. I often think that this is the reason he chose Paris to settle in later on. Okay, so, and now it's coming closer. The Russians are already close to Lvov. And one day, we hear a knocking on the manhole, and we hear Socha saying, this is Socha, you can come out now, you're free. Now this is the way you are going to come out. First, Jakob, then Mr. Hig, no, first Jakob, then Mrs. Higa, then Krzysia, then Pavel, then Halina, then Clara, then Korsash, and then Mr. Higa. Mr. Higger will come out last because the captain of a ship goes last. And so we went out. When Pavel's turn came, we were just discussing that this weekend again, Pavel started to cry. He was 5 years old now, 5 1/4, and it was a beautiful, sunny 27th of July, 1944. He started to cry because he had forgotten what the sun and the sky looked like, even though we talked about it there. And he was used to the sewer, and he said, I'm afraid, I want to go back to the sewer. But there, with a push, he came out, And we went out through a manhole in the courtyard of a building which was occupied by Germans, which were German officers during the war, during the German occupation, but the building which belonged to a friend of Mrs. Higger's parents. When we came out, the landlady, I mean, not the landlady, but the, how do you say, the caretaker of a house, the janitor was a woman. She was there, and several occupants of the building were there, and this woman's daughter. And she was just reminding me, Mrs. Higger, she says, do you remember how she said, my God, she said, all these months, she said, I saw steam coming out of the manhole, and my daughter was telling me it's because it's cold outside, it's cold up, it's cold here, but it's warm there, it's warm here, or cold there, she said. She said, it's a chemical reaction. She says, little did I know that there were Jews underneath me. What the sewer workers did prior to getting us out, they went into the building, the Germans had, of course, retreated, they went into the building, and had occupied an apartment which had been deserted by the Germans. And when we came out, they took us up straight into the elevator, up into that apartment. Shortly after that came their wives and their children. It was the first time that we met their wives and children. They brought again vodka and some food, and we toasted one another, and we celebrated. There we stayed. I don't remember exactly how long, but this is where we slept the first night and the second, and possibly a week or two. I just have to recall, I have to check these things. These details I just never talked about, and I shoved them out of my memory. But I remember how we began meeting some other survivors. In fact, this
Before you go on, how did you feel upon entering the world again?
Okay. First of all, this is again what we were discussing this weekend, how we all looked at each other, and we saw we looked peculiar. I mean, we didn't see how strange we looked in the sewer. We were very good looking to one another. And all of a sudden, now we came out and everybody was yellow. Our hair, incidentally, turned a different color too. And we looked very strange and very peculiar. Our feet were swollen, like Mrs. Higger just recalled. She said how her feet were very, very swollen. Jakob couldn't walk at all for a while. We were afraid. The very first reaction was fear. The very first reaction was fear. In fact, the very first reaction upon going out through the manhole and seeing the janitor, the few Gentiles, the few people over the manhole, even we adults experienced a fear of betrayal. And the first question was to Socha, are you sure that it's safe? Incidentally, we did not come out the first day the Germans entered, the Russians entered, because Socha was very cautious. You see, in another town close by, the Germans retreated, the Russians came in, and the Jews, the few Jews that saved themselves in the forest or wherever, came out of hiding. In the meantime, the Germans beat back the Russians, and the Jews were killed. In another town, the local population killed every Jew who came out of hiding. So Socha was afraid what might happen to us, so he still waited until it was safe. But still, when we came out, we were terribly scared. We were scared to go anywhere, but we stayed in that building, and they were with us and sort of guarding us.
Before you go on, I'd like to ask you about illness in the ghetto. You mentioned the sore throat.
You mean the sewer.
In the sewer. You mentioned the sore throat. Was there any illness among?
No. No, we were well. The only thing was, and it was for them, it was always a cause of laughter and teasing. For me, it was great suffering. The whole group felt that I was a spoiled brat. It's true, I was an only daughter and the youngest, and I was, there's no question, I was very much, how shall I say, not spoiled, but
fussed
over. But I wasn't a spoiled brat. What was happening was I had constant stomach pains. And they said that, number one, I faked it because I didn't want to go for water. And number two, I was simply a spoiled brat and was psychosomatic. I said it was because of the sitting. At least that's how I felt. It always hurt me like, what do you call this here?
Heartburn.
No, not heartburn. Like
esophagus?
Whatever it is. Now I should know because afterwards, and I will tell you, I will relate to you. But it always, it felt like my stomach hurt, but above the stomach, you know, under my breast. And it always hurt there. So I said, well, maybe because I'm always curled up. So I, on occasion, would take a walk under a manhole and stretch out and take in a lung full of fresh air and feel relieved. Or when the others would move away a little and there was enough room to lie down, like during the day, not just, I always wanted to be lying down. Even today, I'm the happiest when I'm lying down. If I could iron lying down, I would. I iron sitting, but I do everything lying down. Reading is no question. I correct my papers lying down, prepare tests. I do everything lying down, except making dittos. So that was that. Well, little did I know at the time what the problem was, and certainly the people didn't believe me. In the poems that I someday hope to translate, and what Mr. Higge wrote about me was, the princess of the Carpathian Mountains is sick. And it went so far that Socha himself called me the princess of the Carpathian Mountains, except with him it was not in a sarcastic sense. He sincerely did. And I said before, no, I didn't say anything about Socha. I'll talk about Socha later. So I had this pain. And after liberation, the pain continued. And when we left Lvov, which was Russia, and moved west to Poland, we came to the city of Krakow, or Krakow, which was last night on television, 60 Minutes, 11 o'clock last night. Did you watch that?
I saw it.
One segment dealt with Americans living in Poland. Now they were talking about the city of Krakow and the University of Krakow. So we came to Krakow, and I immediately had to check into a hospital because I not only had pains, I had attacks. And I was ignorant, and so apparently were the doctors. In retrospect, I am not sure they were real doctors. They may have been people who claimed that they had degrees or whatever. Nobody could tell me what the problem was. My attacks were horrible. I spent a few weeks in the hospital, and I thought for a while there that who knows, if they don't know what it is, it must be cancer. I will jump now to, in order to continue the subject, I went from Poland to Czechoslovakia. From Czechoslovakia, I came to America. When I came to America, I got my first attack the week after I arrived. My brother took me to New York to a doctor. The doctor promptly established I had gallstones. And I must be operated on. They removed my gallstones, and it's the best thing that ever happened to me, and I've been very healthy ever since, except for other things. But apparently those gallstones started out in the sewer, but I certainly didn't know anything about it, and neither did the other people. But the taunting of the people was as excruciating as the pain itself. As for the other people, I don't know whether I was so self-centered at the time that I cannot remember, or were they really well. I really think they were well because I have met with some of these people since, and we have been amazed. In fact, Leon Velichko writes in the book about the amazing thing, and so did Belayev and Ogonyok in Russia write, the amazing thing was that none of us were sick in the sewer. Now, when he wrote none of us were sick, he didn't say how much I suffered, but then it was taken for granted absolutely that I was faking it. So there was no point, and he never interviewed me personally, so he never got my side of the story, so that I was faking it, so nobody was sick in the sewer. When we came out, I think I was the only one who was sick. Let me see, Higger was not, of course, we parted ways. Let me make this brief. I had forgotten who went where when. And I recall that this weekend, Mrs. Higger tells me that I and whoever left first. I believe I was. First, is it 5 o'clock? Quarter past five?
It's 25 past.
Oh, is it? No, that's all right. I don't mean. I'll just talk about arriving in America. Okay, so. When I came out, we were anxious to see if there are any other Jews, and our sewer workers were on the lookout for some other Jews, and we started gathering together, and we sort of immediately formed like a committee, and as we did, there was a young man, a good-looking young man, a little older than I, and he asks me, is there anybody else alive? Do you have anybody else? I said, no, not to my knowledge. I said, I have a brother in America. I said, do you have anybody? He says, well, not to my knowledge, but I have a sister in America, in New York, and I have a brother in New York, and that was enough to bring us together. And so he was with us. Then an elderly woman came out. Anybody alive? No, but I have a sister in America. She had lost her husband, had no children, and so she became our mother. And then a young boy came out, and is anybody alive? No.
When you say came out, are you saying?
From hiding, from hiding. Wherever they came. This young man was hidden somewhere by a janitor in a public school. Then this young boy came out. His name was Leon Velichko. And by the time I met him, he must have been 17. He was very young when he was in the Yanovsky camp. I will not talk too much about him because he had written his memoirs after the camp was liquidated. He had managed to survive in various places and to write him a diary. That diary he saved, and upon liberation, he met a former teacher of his whose name was Dr. Eberova, Mrs. Eber, and also a famous historian had survived, Dr. Philip Friedman. Dr. Philip Friedman married Dr. Eberova, who had lost her husband, and the two of them, this Dr. Eberova, found Leon Velichko. She got him in touch with Dr. Friedman, and they induced him to give them his diary, which he did, which they published in Poland for the first time in Polish for whatever it was worth. Years later, it was published in France, and my husband was in France at the time. He had gone from Germany, where he was a witness at the Auschwitz trial, and in France, in Paris, he visited Jakub, who had made his life there. Jakub, incidentally, met a girl from a lodge and married her, a beautiful young girl. She married him, this hunchback, and they settled in Paris. Jakub told George that Leon Velichko's book came out in French. George bought it. When George came back to the United States a little while later, one night when George was out of town, I get a call from Rabbi Kraft, who is my rabbi. It was rather late. It was like 11 o'clock at night or 12 o'clock at night. Frankly, I got scared. And he says to me, Helena, how are you? Fine, thank you. And I thought, my God, something happened. Why does a rabbi call late at night? He says, I have regards for you from your brother. My brother is also a rabbi. I said, thank you very much. And then I feel like asking, well, why are you calling me at night to give me regards? He says, I just saw him at convention. It turned out that the book was, I don't remember how much later after it was published in France, maybe even a year later, I don't recall the sequence now. It had just come out here, it was published by Macmillan, this is the book, and apparently the book was discussed at the Rabbinical Assembly Convention. And Rabbi Kraft discovered that this book, which was the topic of discussion at that convention, this book had a girl by the name of Helena. And while he was there, my brother was there too, and of course some of the people knew who the Helena was because I had been speaking about it for the seminary all over the country and in temple sisterhoods, so the rabbis knew that I was Leon's sister. So they talked to Leon about it, except Rabbi Kraft didn't know who it was. So he comes home and he said, he says, do you know a man by the name of Leon Velichka? Or now he calls himself Wells. I say, yes, I know him very well. He's a fellow survivor. He's a friend of mine. In fact, I said, I have introduced him. I had introduced him to a classmate of mine at the seminary whom he married, whom he later divorced. And now I understand he's remarried and he has some children. He lives somewhere. I don't know where. I lost track of him. He says, do you know he published a book? I said, yes, I heard about it. He says, you know, the book has a girl by the name of Helena who married an engineer in the United States who has two children, who was in the sewer. Is that you? And I said, yes. He says, I have known you all these years, and I never knew about it. Why didn't you tell me? I said, you never asked.
But you didn't meet George
No, I met George through speaking. I was speaking in Camden, New Jersey, which was my very first engagement outside of New York City. And apparently one of the sisterhood president or chairperson had heard me in New York City addressing a convention. And she came back to Camden, which was the case. The women came back to their local communities and then called the seminary and asked for me, and I was such a greener at the time that the seminary wouldn't let me go alone. They sent along the secretary, Torah Fund secretary, to accompany me to Camden, New Jersey. I didn't know where it was. So she took me to Camden, New Jersey, and there I spoke. And some much time later, I received a letter from this woman telling me what a good impression I had made on her. And she has a cousin, also a survivor, who lives in Boston. He's an engineer by profession, an artist by vocation. And would I be interested in meeting him? At the time, I had a boyfriend, so I wasn't interested in meeting him. And then I shed that boyfriend, that he was the boyfriend whom I met right after the
operation. That's why.
Right. And the rest, of course, is history. We've been married 26 years now. To update the whereabouts of the rest of the group, of the 21 people who went down into the sewer, 10 of us survived. The entire Higer family, father, mother, and two children. Clara and Mundek survived. They live in London. They have a married daughter and two grandchildren. They have a son, and they are in the kosher catering business in London. Jakob had settled in Paris with his wife, has two, I understand, absolutely brilliant children. His son is very brilliant, and as of this weekend, I heard that his son is in Chicago. He has never contacted me. I mean, his son didn't, and I don't know where he is. But with Jakob, yes, I was corresponding, but Jakob died about 5 years ago of cancer. So Jakob was the first one to die. About 3 years ago, yes, all these years I did not know where the Higers were. I had heard they had left Poland and had gone to Israel. I had asked people all the time to find them for me, but no one could. I asked my brother when he went. Finally, I asked my cousin, who was coming here from Israel, to bring me a telephone book, and I'm going to find it myself. I was unable to find them even then. Then about 3 years ago, I received a call one day, one morning, it was a Monday morning, and somebody says, Halina, in Polish, and I say, yes, and he says, how are you, fine? And one thing, the first question was a wrong question. He said to me, do you remember Turka? Turka is my hometown. And that was the mistake he made, because when he said, do you remember Turka, I really I lost my speech, because I thought that's a member of the family, maybe my brother, father, I don't know who. Had he said, do you remember the sewer, maybe I would have thought of someone from the sewer. So I pleaded with him, well, who are you? Tell me who you are. He said, do you remember Higa? So I said, Mrs. Higa said the other night, she said, he came home, he said, Halina Stad kept saying, no, it's not true, where are you? I remember saying, where have you been all these years? I've been looking for you. He says, well, we've been living in Israel all these years. I said, but I couldn't find you. He said, because we had changed our name. So apparently they changed their name in Poland yet. They changed it to Chirovsky. And when they came to Israel, they never rechanged it to Higer, which is a very good Hebrew name. And they were under Chirovsky in Israel all these years. So I asked him about his family, so he told me. I said, how is Ksheshia? Fine, he says. She is a dentist in New York. She's been living in New York 7 years now. Well, I almost flipped. I couldn't. I said, why in the world didn't she get in touch with me? Then he said, we didn't know your address. I said, how did you find it now? He says, well, we wrote to Mundek in London, and Mundek just called us last night. He said, in fact, he says, we were in a town called Baltimore, and he said we were passing through a town called Wilmington. He said, and I kept saying, he says, my daughter, my son-in-law, and I kept saying to my son-in-law, it sounds so familiar, I could swear that somebody told me that Halina lives in Wilmington. He said, that was yesterday, Sunday. We came home last night, and 10 o'clock at night, Monday called from London and sent us your address. So he said, so here I'm calling you. So, of course, my husband and I, we asked him to come here, but they couldn't, she didn't feel well. So my husband and I and Sherry, our daughter, went to New York, and for the first time after 30 years, we met Mr. and Mrs. Higa and Christine. After having seen her as a child of 8, I had seen her now for the first time as a woman of 30. Let's see, she is now 41, so she was 37. She had at the time a son of, he's now 15, so he was then 12. No, he was 13, so he must be now 16. And she had just had a baby, and that baby is now 3 years old. So they were leaving for Israel. The parents were leaving for Israel. So again, she was still sick, so we went back to New York to see them. In fact, I was speaking at Beth Emmet that Friday night. I was addressing a regional convention. I was telling them the story about how I had seen these people after 30 years. And then one day, I received a call from Ksheshia. She had just returned from Israel. Her father had died of a heart attack. That was 2 years ago, about a year after I had seen him. And Mrs. Higer came to New York about a year ago. She's been here for about a year. And I've been begging her all this year to come to see us. But she couldn't, she wouldn't, and so forth. At any rate, this past summer, while she was here, we went to Israel. Oh, yes. And then their son Pavel, who was 4 years old in the sewer, 5 years old when he was liberated, he remained in Israel. He married a Polish girl, remained in Israel, has two children, two teenage children, I think, and he is a dental technician in Israel. Last year, he was visiting his sister here, and he came to see me, and when he walked in this door, this was a spitting image of his father. He was exactly the age his father was when I had known him 30 years ago. He came to see me, but that I don't think so much to see me, as he came to make a tape of the tape we made of his father when we saw him in New York. He said they didn't have any tape of his father. Mrs. Higge hadn't come here all this time, but when we were this past summer from Israel, we went to London, and for the first time we met Mundek and Clara and their children. Henry, their son, had been here 2 years ago, but Henry was in Venezuela with his sister and brother-in-law this week, and this weekend he came here. So we saw Henry for the third time. We saw him 2 years ago here, we saw him in the summer in Israel, and we saw him now for the third time. And on Thursday night, we got a call from New York. He said that he's coming in Friday night. No, Wednesday he called, he's coming in Friday night. Thursday night, Krzysia calls, Christine. She says, Halina, my mother is coming with Henry. So Mrs. Higge was here for the first time this weekend. And she's a fantastic woman. She always was. I must make this point. I really must. She is a complete resemblance of my mother, physically. Even in the sewer, I felt this way. And now that she is even older, she was sitting here, and every time I looked at her, I thought my mother is sitting here. And then there's something very strange. When I am in her presence or in any of their presence, I call my daughter Krzysia. All the time that I was talking with her, if I wanted to say Sherry, I said Krzysia. Apparently there, you see, Krzysia was.
Does it make you feel like a child again?
What?
When you're in their presence?
No. It doesn't seem like we didn't see each other all these years. No, the first time I saw them after 30 years, I had no feeling that I hadn't seen them all these years. It was just like an old reunion. So, and this brings us up to date.
Yes, I'd like to ask you, what ingredient do you think helped you and that people in the sewer to survive under such duress?
Mm-hmm. I'll say, I will give you my personal feeling, and then I think there are certain things I can say are general and maybe pertain to all survivors. With me personally, as I pointed out, when my parents sent me out, they didn't say anything, and we didn't cry. The only thing was that I am to remember the address of the seminary. Remember that? When I said that, when I traveled and spoke on behalf of the seminary, it sounded like a plug. At the time, I didn't understand it because I was not yet Americanized sufficiently to understand that people may conceive of it as a plug for the seminary. But that was the truth, the honest truth. The reason being that if I should survive, I should be able to locate my brother and reclaim my own identity. And therefore, and I saw it, I know it sounds corny, but well, I suppose the real truth is corny, because those things are corny. They have been said and repeated so many times that they become corny. I had a mission. I wasn't just saving my life. Okay, so I will live. And in fact, often in order to have strength, to be able to take something, we would say to ourselves, okay, so let's pretend we have already lived 70 years, we married, we had children, we had grandchildren, it's time to die, period. I mean, nobody lives forever. But no, so dying, you know, wasn't really the worst thing. But we had a purpose and a cause and a reason for living. And you know something, again, it'll sound corny, that when you have a purpose and when you have a cause, then you're able to endure everything. Number one, I was charged with a mission. I was living for my parents. I was living for my brother. I was living for my yet unborn children. I was living for the past and I was living for the future. The present is not really that important. And you know something? It just dawned on me now, as I'm saying these words for the very first time, people have often said to me, stop living in the past, and I resent this tremendously because I don't live in the past. And my George has said to me often, you're already talking, you're already retired, and you're already in the Kutz home, and you're already dying, which means I'm already living in the future. Why don't you live today? As I'm thinking now, I don't know, maybe it is that philosophy of not living today. People often say, I don't care what's going to happen tomorrow, and I don't care what happened in the past. Today counts. With me, today doesn't count. The past counts, and the future counts. Today is today, tomorrow is another day. And I have often said that, you know, I do that. This with work, okay, whatever won't get done today, so it'll get done tomorrow. What I didn't do today, sometimes I feel guilty, oh, I didn't do such and such, which I should have done. Okay, there is a tomorrow. I will still do it tomorrow. And for the first time now, I have formulated that as possibly, I don't know for sure, but possibly, I'm not a psychiatrist.